All right, it looks like you all have already checked in with the clerk and allocated your time and your additional time between sides and lawyers. I have Ms. Smith down for 20 minutes and 5 for rebuttal. And I have Ms., is it Zavarelli? Did I say that correctly? All right, I have you down for 10. And Mr. Keith, you're arguing, and you're 10 as well. And I understand you're arguing first for the appellees.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, well, thank you. We will begin then with Ms. Smith.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. This case involves a 22-year-old young man, Aaron Gower, who is certainly a troubled young man, and he was an inpatient at University Behavioral Health Facility, which is owned and operated by UHS. He was under the care of a psychiatrist, Dr. Vasaveda. This is a medical malpractice claim, and in order to comply with the medical malpractice statute, we timely filed an expert report by a board-certified psychiatrist with appropriate qualifications, been board-certified for over 30 years, providing care and treatment to people just like Mr. Gower in an inpatient setting. He had specific qualifications as to the treatment that was provided to Mr. Gower. Those were set forth in the report. The report provided factual basis for each one of the elements of the claim as required by Chapter 74.351 specifically, and addressed each one of those elements sufficiently to form a good faith basis. Now, the court in Certified EMS versus POTS thankfully clarified some of the hurdles that plaintiffs had been required to jump over to make sure that we were satisfying the statutory scheme within Chapter 74. In Certified EMS versus POTS, the court held that to constitute a good faith effort under the statute, plaintiff need only provide defendants with reasonable notice as to the actual problems or concerns with the care that had been rendered, and we have to submit to the court a sufficient basis for the court to find that the claims have merit. We certainly did that before Judge Bailey and presented evidence as to each one of those claims. Specifically, in addressing the good faith effort, Dr. Burrell submitted a six-page report laying out his qualifications, and each one of the standard of care aspects that applied to Dr. Vasaveda as well as the hospital defendant. Now, there is a typographical error that I'm sure you're going to hear about, and you have heard about in our briefing, where there is another patient mentioned in one paragraph on page 3 of that report. This is at page 288 of the clerk's transcript. Now, I would like to point out to the court that this is an error in one paragraph. Mr. Gower's name is mentioned in every other paragraph of the entire report. And I would submit to the court that even if this entire section was struck, meaning section A on page 2 of the report was entirely gone, then this report would still be sufficient under the parameters that we've received from the Supreme Court in Certified EMS versus POTS. Specifically, section A is the direct liability allegations as to the defendant, Universal Health Services, Inc. So this is the parent company over University Behavioral Health, where Aaron Gower actually was an inpatient, right? So under Gardner and under POTS, it was made clear that allegations of the underlying entity, meaning the, either the physician or the facility where the patient has been hospitalized, if the allegations in the report are sufficient as to those entities, then the claims may proceed because all we have to do is establish one theory of liability. And under vicarious liability, the parent company moves forward with its agent, or in this case, University Behavioral Health. Now, we specifically set forth the various aspects of the care that were deficient in this case. Specifically, the hospital defendant, which I'll address first, failed to provide any type of reasonable monitoring with the significant and severe conditions that Mr. Gower presented with. He was deemed a harm to himself and a harm to others, and he was under significant medications that were being adjusted on a daily or on another.
But that sort of oversight or lack of oversight for those conditions was not, that wasn't what caused his death, though, right?
It was, actually. And that's a very good question, Justice Kerr. I'm glad that you brought that up, because in this particular case, the defendants have relied on extrinsic evidence, which I will address partially in my argument in a little bit. But the autopsy report is something that Dr. Burrell relied upon, and he specifically made that causal link between the both defendants' failure to provide reasonable monitoring, medication, and care to his premature death, meaning if, and it's specifically set forth on page 5 and 6 of the report, which is pages 290 and 291 of the clerk's transcript, if they would have provided monitoring and further evaluation every single time that they noticed that his blood pressure was elevated on January 18th, 22nd, 23rd, 25th, and February 1st, then appropriate medication could have been given, and that would have saved his life. Dr. Burrell states, in summary, the conduct called into question is the failure by UBH, its parent company, and Dr. Vasaveda to recognize and properly treat Mr. Gower's symptoms and failure to provide the appropriate medications that ultimately led to his untimely death. Furthermore, the parties also failed to meet the standard of care as described above by failing to adequately respond to Mr. Gower's distress or have proper life-saving equipment available. Now,
let me ask a question, though, before you go on. When you talk about the lack of monitoring and failure to provide the adequate medication, isn't one of the problems or concerns raised by the report, it's really difficult to tell whether we're talking about the psychiatric medications and whether those were appropriate, as opposed to maybe additional medications relative to hypertension?
Well, that is a good question as well. In the context of this case, the proper monitoring and the proper medication provides notice to the defendants as to what conduct is at issue. Maybe the defendants want more information as to what specific medication should have been given or when those should have been given and whether or not the monitoring was with respect to all aspects of his medication management, including psychotropic medications. However, this, as the court knows, discovery is stayed until the report is resolved. So when it comes to those type of areas, defendants can inquire what medications were insufficient, what should have been done, how were the medications not administered properly, or what type of monitoring should have been provided. But really, in the context of the Supreme Court's directive, we just have to put the defendant on notice of the conduct. And based on all the briefing, defendants were certainly aware of the conduct in question because they briefed extensively on it and took issue with the monitoring and medication aspects of this case. Now, if the defendants are arguing about that, then they certainly are on notice of the claims that are at issue to the defendants. And this is a very minimal standard. Very minimal standard. This, in the context of an expert report, we have a very short time to marshal sufficient information to make a determination as to whether or not this case should go forward, whether or not I'm going to move forward and represent these clients for the wrongful death of their son and grandson. So in the context of this case, we have limited information, and the legislature is well aware and anticipated that this is a very minimal standard. Now
is that essentially the explanation for why, I mean, as I understand the timeline, you still had 48 days or so left within your 120 days when the first round of objections to Dr. Burrell's report were filed. So you could have amended it or changed it. So I assume that you just felt that his initial report got you over the threshold?
Well, that is also extrinsic evidence that Judge Bailey considered, which should not have been considered at all.
That's just the timeline, though, right?
That is the timeline. And until the court finds that there is any deficiency in the report, there is no duty to amend. Plus, we had this unique context of where, after we had our expert reviewed the records, there was an additional physician's conduct that was implicated. So we had to amend the petition, serve the expert report on that defendant. And honestly, Your Honor, I decided that it would be better to have all of the challenges heard at the same time as opposed to filing one expert report, then another, then having that second one challenged, because then in the context of having a second report challenged, what is the court going to do? If we're allowed one 30-day period to amend, then do I get two opportunities to cure that report if that report implicates each one of the defendant's conduct? So in the scheme, if we've presented a good faith basis for the claims, which I believed we had, and I think the report is entirely sufficient, except for the error with respect to a patient's name. That is absolutely an error. But that does not mean that the entire report should be struck. And certainly in the context of what the legislature's intent was for Chapter 74, it's to deter frivolous claims, but not block bona fide claims. I think the Scoresby case is very instructive on what the purpose of the statute is. And because there is a word may allow for a cured report or allow for an extension of time to file an amended report, that word cannot be used or abused by trial court judges to block claims that have merit. And if the facts before the court are sufficient to show that the claims have merit, then the claims must survive, let alone an opportunity to cure for the very first time. I wanted to point out to the court that we cited two standards of review in the context of this case. I agree that in interpreting the good faith standard, that is certainly a factual issue. That's something that needs to be resolved by the court under the evidence in the report. However, and I actually had to kind of revisit these issues, which I've briefed before this court before, but in the context of whether or not there is a report within the meaning of the statute, that I would submit to you is a question of law that should be interpreted de novo, as opposed to it being interpreted under an abusive discretion standard. And specifically, the Scoresby case addresses exactly what a report is, and if a report has been submitted and has been timely submitted, then the plaintiffs must be granted an opportunity to cure if those deficiencies are curable. It says, and this is at page 549 of the Scoresby decision, it says, based on the Act's text and stated purpose, we hold that a document qualifies as an expert report if it contains a statement of an opinion by an individual with expertise indicating that the claim asserted by plaintiff against the defendant has merit. It goes on, an individual's lack of relevant qualifications and an opinion's inadequacies or deficiencies, the plaintiff should be given an opportunity to cure if possible. That's exactly what the defendants argued in this case, that our Dr. Burrell was not qualified to render opinions and that his opinions were deficient. So in the context of that particular case, the court needs to look to see whether or not did the plaintiff actually submit a report under the context of the statutory scheme and under the Supreme Court's mandate that which where time to actually amend and cure deficiencies must be granted. So I would submit to the court that the de novo standard would be appropriate in analyzing whether or not this is a report at all. We also made sure under the Samlowski case that we did cure this report, and we timely cured this report, even though the court did not allow us to do that. Under the directives of Samlowski, in that case, the plaintiff failed to provide an expert report because she was not required to do so. And the Supreme Court, in a plurality opinion, decided that, well, we can't really replace our judgment for the trial court's judgment and say that it could be cured if we don't have a report that shows that those deficiencies could be cured. So we submitted, just as Samlowski instructed, an amended report of Dr. Burrell within that 30-day period after the hearings were, after the hearings on the motions to dismiss were heard. And we submitted two reports, one by Dr. Burrell and one by a nursing consultant, he is a PhD, but Nurse Bays. And those reports were not even considered by the trial court on our motion for new trial, which shows further in the context of whether or not an amendment should be allowed to the expert reports that this court acted arbitrarily. Judge Bailey acted arbitrarily and not within the statutory scheme and not under the principles and rules that guide trial courts as to what to do in these circumstances. In fact, Judge Bailey said that this was an easy call for him, an easy decision for him to dismiss this case without allowing any opportunity to cure. And he indicated that he was one of the reasons that he allowed that is because of the delay in plaintiffs correcting any deficiencies. Now, this was absolutely beyond the four corners of the report and absolutely considered by the court improperly and shows another abuse of discretion in the context of whether or not an amendment should have been allowed. It's also important to note that when the court considered these additional steps that were taken in the context of the timeline, he also considered evidence that was attached to the briefs of defendant UBH regarding the specific context of what happened in this case and what Dr. Burrell had relied upon. In Palacios, this court, the Supreme Court, after this court considered that case, held that everything must be within the four corners of the report to be considered by the court. And in fact, in that case, the plaintiff, who suffered brain damage and then fell again out of a hospital bed and injured themselves. The plaintiff in that case was asking the court to draw inferences as to what specific conduct had occurred right before the fall that allegedly caused further brain damage. And the court said we cannot consider whether or not there's an inference of what happened. We only can consider what's in the report. Your Honors, I see my time is almost up. I will also state that the attorney's fees that were awarded were unreasonable and went beyond the scope of what the statute is designed to allow for. only the time spent opposing the motion or drafting the motion to dismiss, and those attorney's fees were unreasonably allowed by the court as they were unsegregated fees, and I will reserve my remaining time.
Let me ask you, can you point to anything in the report that explains a relationship between the admitting physician and, I guess, the other doctor is called a consult, or?
I hope I'm answering your question correctly. Mr. Garrow was under the care and treatment of Dr. Vasaveda and Dr. Dupree. And in the report, and I'll find the specific site, but in the report it says that Dr. Vasaveda was in charge of the care and treatment that was rendered to Mr. Gower. And I think...
Well, I've got it here. That's fine.
Okay. I will find a specific site for that.
All right. Thank you.
That type of doctor is really referred to as a captain of the ship, somebody that's in charge of all the care that's provided. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Smith. All right. We have Mr. Keith first arguing for, let's see, Dr. Vasaveda, correct?
Dr. Vasaveda.
Vasaveda. All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, Dr. Vasaveda asked this court to affirm Judge Bailey's dismissal order and the exercise of his statutory discretion to deny a 30-day extension to file another expert report, because he made the factual determinations that Dr. Burrell's report as to Dr. Vasaveda was insufficient and did not represent a good faith effort to comply with the requirements of Chapter 74. Judge Bailey stated in the record that making the determination of what is or is not a sufficient report under Chapter 74 is the most intellectually challenging and frustrating thing that he does as a district court judge, and I suspect that's true for most Texas judges and the practicing bar. However, in this case, Judge Bailey did state that while he was sympathetic because a young person had lost his life here, it was not a difficult call for him to determine that Dr. Burrell's report was not a good faith representation of a qualified expert factually explaining the causal relationship between Dr. Vasaveda's conduct and Aaron Gower's death. Now, Palacios does tell us that an expert report, to be acceptable, must represent a good faith effort to provide an opinion on what the statute requires, and that is it must describe the standard of care applicable to Dr. Vasaveda. It must explain how his conduct breached the standard of care, and it must establish a causal connection between that breach by Dr. Vasaveda and the alleged harm. Dr. Burrell's report satisfies none of these elements with respect to Dr. Vasaveda. And another guiding principle from the Scoresby case that Judge Bailey followed is that a 30-day extension to cure a deficient report may be granted, one, if it's timely filed, and that's not an issue here, but it also must contain the opinion of an individual with expertise that the claim has merit, and if the report implicates the defendant's conduct. Dr. Burrell's report was not a curable good faith effort because it failed to satisfy requirements 2 and 3 of the Scoresby test for curability. First and foremost in this case, this is a wrongful death medical negligence case. At a minimum, the report must identify the patient's cause of death. Dr. Burrell's report does not do this. Section C of the report, which is dedicated to Dr. Vasaveda, simply refers to, quote, Mr. Gower's death, close quote, and, quote, his untimely death, close quote. In an earlier fact recitation in the report, It states, quote, "His family was advised Mr. Gower had suffered severe brain damage due to a lack of oxygen for an extended period of time," close quote. That is not Dr. Burrell's expert opinion as to the cause of death. It is a conclusory hearsay statement of what an unidentified person said to the family. It is also not a medical cause of death opinion because it does not explain what caused the patient to be without oxygen for an extended period of time. That could be any number of things. It could be caused.
Do you not think an amended report could have cured that?
Well, they're only entitled to an amended report if they represent a good faith effort to address that issue from the outset. And in a wrongful death case, not to identify the cause of death is utterly devoid of a substantive opinion to represent to the trial court that the case has merit. There could have been something that causes a patient to have an extended period of lack of oxygen, an obstruction in his airway. Psychiatric patients sometimes hang themselves. This could have been a drowning. There could be any number of medical or physical reasons why someone would suffer severe brain damage as a result of a lack of oxygen for an extended period of time. So that factual recitation, that hearsay factual recitation, in no way is a statement or an opinion of a cause of death in this case. Of even greater importance here is that the report does not implicate Dr. Vasavada's conduct as having contributed to the cause of death, whatever that is. Section C of the report has four paragraphs in it purportedly to inform the district court that the case has merit as to Dr. Vasavada. Paragraph 1 criticizes the internist, Dr. Dipri, for noting in the chart that he had treated the patient's hypertension but didn't provide any more details. Paragraph 1 then criticizes Dr. Vasavada's discharge summary prepared post-mortem for stating that an internal medicine consult was ordered, the patient was evaluated, but then no findings are documented in the discharge summary, which was prepared post-mortem. There is no way that a lack of charting post-mortem, or in this case generally, caused the death of Mr. Gower. Paragraph 1 concludes that because the chart lacks proper documentation, Dr. Dipri and Dr. Vasavada fell below the standard of care. Thus, in paragraph 1, it does not establish the required causal link between Dr. Vasavada's breach of an undefined standard of care and an unidentified cause of death. And before we move on from paragraph 1 and the standard of care element, nowhere in this report does it simply state the standard of care applicable to a board-certified psychiatrist like Dr. Vasavada, who has engaged an internal medicine consult, is to, and then fill in the blanks, which is then usually followed by another paragraph factually explaining how the physician's conduct breached that established standard of care. This report is absolutely silent as to a standard of care applicable to Dr. Vasavada or how he breached it. But getting back to the critical question of how his conduct was implicated as causing Mr. Gower's death, paragraphs 2 and 3 of this report, remembering that there's only 4 paragraphs here that are dedicated to Dr. Vasavada, paragraphs 2 and 3 of Section C address criticisms of UBH's nurses and emergency equipment. There's no substantive opinions implicating Dr. Vasavada's conduct as a cause of death. So you get to the 4th and final paragraph of this report, it's a conclusory causation summary directed at all of the defendants, and it states that all of the defendants, including Dr. Vasavada, failed to recognize and properly treat Mr. Gower's symptoms. No identification, are we talking psychiatric symptoms, medical symptoms, and to provide the appropriate medications that ultimately lead to his death. Which symptoms should have been treated differently and how? The report is silent on that. Which medications would have been appropriate and how they would have changed the outcome? The report is silent about that. You know, Judge Bailey, also in the record, he was searching for the cause of death in this case in the report. And he said that ordinarily he would read and expect to read in a expert report in a wrongful death medical negligence case and come away with the understanding of how and why this patient died. He said he read Dr. Burrell's report with that perspective and came away with confusion. And I submit to this court that if you give a good look at that report, you'll come away equally confused, because it is devoid, it is utterly devoid of a substantive opinion as to what the cause of death was and how Dr. Vasavada's conduct is implicated in causing it.
All right, Mr. Keith, can you wrap up there? Or were you through?
Well, did I have 2 minutes left?
No, you've already gone through your extra 2 minutes. If you could just come to a concluding statement, please.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. While it is true that the standard to grant an extension is a lenient standard, it is a standard, and it is not an automatic extension. And Judge Bailey's exercise of his discretion that Dr. Burrell's report did not represent a good faith effort to establish the patient's cause of death or to implicate Dr. Vasavada's conduct as having caused it should be affirmed. Thank you.
I have one question. In your opinion, is there any distinction to be made for a request for an extension that's filed and heard within the 120-day period versus one that happens later than the 120-day period? Is there a difference?
You know, I don't know if any court has really addressed that issue. I think what the 120 days and the concern that Judge Bailey had with respect to, you know, being a year out and still factual errors in this report within the four corners of this report, like the wrong patient being named, not being corrected, simply it's that the plaintiffs lost an opportunity during those time periods, especially after the objections to these factual errors were made, and the time limit still had time remaining. And then when Dr. Dupree was joined and answered, and another 120-day time period, you know, restarted, but nothing was done with respect to this. So I think they lost an opportunity to affirmatively show Judge Bailey good faith effort.
Well, is it your contention that the expert report's obvious typo, putting somebody else's patient in there, rises to the level to make it not a report at all?
No, not with respect.
It doesn't go to the merits.
Not with respect to that, Justice Kerr. And we refer to that in our brief, but what we are relying on is that under Scoresby and Palacios, it is utterly devoid of substantive opinions with respect to Dr. Vasavada, with respect to an applicable standard of care, that he breached that standard of care, that there's a causal relationship between his conduct and this young man's death, and we don't even have in the report what the cause of death was.
All right.
And all that is within the four corners of the report.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keith. All right, Ms. Zavarelli.
Good afternoon. Glynis Savarelli on behalf of the Appalese University Behavioral Health Denton and Universal Health Systems. I refer to those as the hospital Appalese for the purpose of the argument. With respect to the hospital Appalese, there are two issues before this court. The first is, did the trial court err in granting our motion to dismiss and in refusing to provide for the 30-day extension requested by the appellant? And the second issue is, with respect to the attorney fees awarded to the appellee hospital, were those appropriate and were those in an amount that supports the work that was performed? We contend that on both, the trial court ruled appropriately. With respect to the hospital appellees, Dr. Burrell's May 2014 report and the report that's appropriately before this court failed on all elements to satisfy the Chapter 74 requirement. Although appellant would suggest that this has become a diluted, minimal, almost inconsequential standard, that's simply not the case. The statute reads, and it hasn't been changed in all the years that it's been in effect, and it even tracks Article 4590I, its predecessor, on what's required to ensure that a claim against a health care provider has its day in court and it's meritorious. And those things are, and starting with, most importantly, the report has to come from a qualified expert. Statute tells us how you determine whether an expert's qualified, and I'll address that in just a bit. But if there's a qualified expert, they have to specifically define the applicable standards of care, the manner in which those standards were violated, breached, or unmet, and how those violations purportedly caused the injuries or damages at issue. Those are still the elements required to have an appropriate Chapter 74 report. And, Your Honors, those have not been diluted, and those have not been minimized. In this case, we took the position and continue to take the position that Dr. Burrell was not qualified either as to the standard of care applicable to the hospital appellees and was not qualified to render a causation opinion in this case. We assert that Dr. Burrell's report and his CV with respect to his qualifications on standard of care do not set forth that he, at the time of his report, May of 2014, or at the time of the care provided to this young man, January, February of 2013, was actively engaged in providing patient care to admitted hospital patients with these types of conditions. He may have done that 20 years in the past. He may still be very active involved in consulting work, in providing expert services, in doing other types of clinical care in an office setting. But there wasn't anything in his report or his CV that spoke to that particular issue. We further take the position, as this court has on a number of occasions, that one way it can be determined whether an expert actually has the appropriate qualifications, either on standard of care or on causation, is actually looking at the substance of the report and seeing how things are worded. Because if an expert is properly qualified, they ought to be able to distinctly and specifically identify the standards of care in a way that makes sense and can be followed. And they also ought to be able to identify the facts that link up to the causation theory. If they're not qualified, they're not going to be able to do that, and we take the position that Dr. Burrell's report glaringly shows that he's not qualified. We additionally have asserted that the standards of care that he set out, whether it was for the what's been referred to here today as the parent company, which we will suggest that's not an appropriate way to refer to that particular entity, but that issue isn't before the court. But the standard of care as to the Universal Health or as to UBH Denton, that those standards of care were not even identified.
Just as sort of a broad brush question, if you have a case with multiple defendants, is it your position that a plaintiff must provide an expert report targeted to each specialty, or can you have one expert that can really opine? I mean, I'm not saying that Dr. Burrell did or didn't, but I mean, could you have one medical expert that was qualified to opine on various medical specialties?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I believe that that's absolutely something that not only is doable and feasible, but actually the courts have supported that. It is an analysis, however, of exactly what this expert is attempting to opine about and what his or her experience actually is on those substantive issues that he or she is giving an opinion. We don't take the position that at the trial court level, plaintiff in this case or any other case has to get four different experts if they've sued four different types of healthcare provider defendants. They might actually be able to find one that can serve all purposes and that can also maybe even serve the causation element. And that would be appropriate. But in the event that they cannot, the statute and the case law that's come behind the statute absolutely provides them the opportunity to get multiple experts' reports to sort of put together a framework to support their claim and make sure it can continue on and that it's meritorious. In this case, however, with respect to Dr. Burrell and his standard of care opinions that he attempted to assert against the hospital appellees, again, it may be a five-page report, Your Honors, but it is not quantity that should be at issue. It is quality of the opinions that should be at issue. And if the report is read closely, what's very obvious is that it is just conclusion after conclusion with broad-based terminology and statements such as they have a duty to monitor their own nurses. They have a duty to monitor and supervise patient care. They have a duty to make sure they have qualified staff. Nothing is defined about what is qualified staff, numbers or types. How do you supervise the nursing care? Who's supposed to be doing it and to what end? Supervise them in what way? Are you supposed to shadow behind every nurse? Are you supposed to have them fill out reports? Nothing is described in that way. Monitor and supervise the patient care. How? I mean, that's easy to say, and almost anybody could make those statements, whether or not they have an MD behind their name. But actually providing the patient care and getting in there and saying, in this specific factual set of circumstances, here's what a nurse must do. And when that doesn't work, then here's what a nurse must do, and here's how they do an intervention, and here's what the actual intervention should be, and what should happen if the intervention doesn't work. None of that is in his report as to either the quote-unquote parent company, Universal, or UBH. And we're not taking the position in this case anything about the vicarious liability or the direct liability with respect to Universal Health. We're taking the position that with respect to whether it's a direct liability claim against Universal Health or a vicarious claim based upon UBH's alleged conduct or misconduct, it's the report still doesn't get you there. The standards of care have not been specifically identified. It is just a recycling over and over again of general conclusory statements. And then when he attempts to put the care with the standards, those aren't specifically identified. So with respect to both the standards of care being set out and the alleged breaches or violations being specifically identified, Dr. Burrell's May 2014 report does neither. And again, we would submit to the court that's likely because he doesn't really know what this nursing staff is supposed to do in its everyday care of patients or how these things are supposed to be handled, implemented, and how these providers are supposed to even interface with or interact with other pertinent healthcare providers in a hospital such as University Behavioral Health of Denton. And then when we
Counsel,
go
let me ask you one question, though. It seems to me in that second full paragraph, when he's talking about the actual facility, it sounds like he does address the issue of high blood pressure and the monitoring required by the staff, even though he might not tell you specifically what a nurse should be doing. But it seems like there is some attempt there to address the blood pressure issue.
And, Your Honor, he does point to a blood pressure issue and that there were various high blood pressures obtained, but doesn't say what was supposed to have been done other than recheck it. Well, even according to his own report, they were rechecked. So there's just a recitation of something that occurred without saying then what should they have done once they rechecked it and what were they supposed to do to follow up on that. It's just literally picking out something from the chart, criticizing it, and not telling us what else was supposed to have been done instead of that. Then when he goes to the causation opinions on behalf of the hospital appellees, his opinion with respect to causation is just as vacant as it was with respect to standard of care. He simply says that had there been timely treatment, he would have survived. That's what's in his May 2014 report. Had he been given timely treatment for his condition, he likely would have survived. And that's not an appropriate causation opinion. Again, we would suggest that Dr. Burrell doesn't have the qualifications to be able to opine as to why this young man's cause of death occurred, while he doesn't bother to point it out in his report. But additionally, even going back as far as Bowie Memorial Hospital, that type of causation opinion was determined to be conclusory. The trial court did not go outside of the four corners of the report to provide its determinations and grant defendant's motion. It stayed within the framework of the four corners, and it simply determined that there was no information which was sufficient on either standard of care, breach of standard of care, or causation inclusive of the qualifications of Dr. Burrell. For those reasons, we would respectfully request that the trial court's rulings be upheld and affirmed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Zavarelli. All right, Ms. Smith, rebuttal.
Thank you. since Ms. Zavarelli was just talking about Bowie, I would like to call the court's attention to the specific facts at issue in that case that the court found were insufficient as to the element of causation. The court at page 53 through 54 discussed the various aspects of the report and the reason that it was deficient on the issue of causation. And it is specifically because the report stated that the patient could possibly have had a better outcome. This was a case involving a broken foot and a misdiagnosis of the broken foot, and whether or not, if that diagnosis had been made sooner, she could have possibly had a better outcome. And that's what the report said. That is where the court found the report deficient. Now, Bowie also is an older case. Before the Supreme Court reviewed the context of the analysis under Chapter 74 and the new version of Chapter 74, including whether or not a plaintiff pleads one theory of liability, the entire case must proceed. One thing that I noticed as to both appellees, they were discussing with the court in detail the exact reasons why this court should reverse the trial court's ruling. Specifically, both of them argued that we did not sufficiently state the elements of the claim and or Dr. Burrell was not qualified. Scoresby has addressed this issue. If a plaintiff fails to provide the court with enough information as to qualifications and or elements, this is at page 554 of Scoresby, then those are deficiencies that the plaintiff must be given an opportunity to cure. That's it. Must be given an opportunity to cure. So if this court is inclined, we submit to you that the report was a good faith effort to comply with Chapter 74 because the defendants were placed on notice, and I'll address that just briefly in a moment. But in the context of whether or not an amendment should be allowed, there are considerations that this court and the Supreme Court have discussed in some of the more recent cases, including the Van Ness case. So in the context of this case, what is going to happen, what could possibly happen, I guess I should say, is that if the court just simply allowed an opportunity to cure, and we didn't do a good job the first time, then he could have granted those motions. He could have granted those motions to dismiss. And this, then we would be before the court under those circumstances right now. However, in the context of this case, if the Court of Appeal, if you find that we did exercise a good faith effort in presenting these issues to the court and the motions to dismiss were properly denied, then the case will move forward. However, if you remand it with instructions to the court to allow for the extension, which happens, then we'll be able to submit those amended reports, and the court will consider them again, and we may be back here again. So when a court of appeals and the Supreme Court is interpreting whether or not an opportunity to cure should be granted, that is to prevent repeated appeals on the same issues. It is also to make sure that the plaintiff is allowed an opportunity to cure any kind of deficiencies as to qualifications, which have been addressed to this court specifically and extensively, and or the elements of the claim. So Under those circumstances, the court abused its discretion in dismissing this case and absolutely acted arbitrarily and contrary to the rules and guidelines set forward in Potts and Scoresby, which require the allowance of an amended report for consideration by the judge as to those elements of the claim. Further, I think that it's important that there are constitutional limits on what courts can do in the context of medical malpractice claims. The importance of a claimant being able to present their evidence, present their case on the merits is of paramount importance, and it was under the legislature's consideration when it drafted Chapter 74. Just because Chapter 74 prohibits frivolous claims, that does not mean that courts can arbitrarily block claims without the day in court that those claims deserve. And we'd ask that the court reverse Judge Bailey's ruling on the motion to dismiss, and or in the alternative, allow our amended reports to move forward and be considered by the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Smith, and thank you to Mr. Keith and Ms. Avarelli. We appreciate all of your arguments today, as well as all the briefing in this matter. We appreciate all of you being here to discuss this case. So your case is now submitted, and that being our last case for the afternoon docket, we will adjourn.